Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Today, we're on a very special Smart Talk road trip. We're coming to you from the brand new Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia. The Revolutionary War was fought between 1775 and 1783. It took longer for this museum to become a reality than the war itself. In 1776, Philadelphia was the largest city in the new nation. Just a few blocks from where I sit was the Pennsylvania State House, now known as Independence Hall. It was where the Continental Congress met and declared the nation's independence from Great Britain. As the center of the American government, Philadelphia was a major target for the British. After a significant victory at the Battle of Brandywine in Chester County, the British captured Philadelphia. That winter, Continental Army Commander George Washington and his troops spent the winter just over 20 miles away at Valley Forge. And that is all part of our story today. Actually, Valley Forge is kind of where this story begins, and you'll hear that story throughout the program today. We have lots of stories. Joining us in our first portion of the program is Michael Quinn, who is president and CEO of the Museum of the American Revolution. Mr. Quinn, welcome to the program.
Scott, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Well, I want to thank you for having us. I mean, the museum has been open for just over a week now.
That's right.
We brought a bus trip from central Pennsylvania, so our listeners are some of the very first visitors to the museum. I had an opportunity to walk through the museum. This is incredible.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been a labor, as you said, of longer than the Revolution, and we think we have created an amazingly exciting story that brings to life the real people of the Revolution and people from all walks of life. And it makes you understand how dramatic this period in our history really was. I mean, it really was a life and death period. And it wasn't like, you know, sending your sons off to war. The war was around you. Everyone, children, women, they were part of this war.
One of the most noticeable parts of the exhibits, the museum itself, just what you said, how it focuses on people. Very often over the years when we've read a textbook, we've seen movies or documentaries about the Revolutionary War, it focuses on the military aspects of it. Now, granted, there is that here, but that focus on people really gives you a sense of what it was like, what that period was like, what the war was like for and many people that a lot of Americans today probably don't think about, but it really does give you a sense of what Americans at that time were feeling and living.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And you're right. You know, typically people look at the military aspects, and there's a good reason for it, which is that we were fighting unbelievable odds. One historian said that there is probably no war in history that was more improbable at the time, and yet from the perspective of 200 years, seems more inevitable. But our real goal was to make you realize that this is people just like us today, people from all walks of life, people who made a decision, who were inspired by that call for independence, that call for liberty, the standard of equality, the promise of the Declaration of Independence, inspired by that to find a shared commitment to fight for independence. And to sustain that for 8 years of warfare. And we want you to understand how powerful that idea was, that this war, this nation was created by individuals making decisions, taking actions. And that's true today. It's people who make history. It's not broad events. It's people.
And at the time, and this is one of the most fascinating aspects of this, we're talking about British subjects. Many people didn't refer to themselves as Americans at that time. They considered themselves British mm-hmm. subjects.
Yeah.
So for them to take up arms, and you know, Americans had been had fought alongside the British just years before in the French and Indian War, and you had people living in the colonies in what would become the United States who took up arms against King George III. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the best exhibits here, just in my opinion, I think everyone else will find it, is you have a replica of a statue of King George III that was in New York.
Yeah.
And this was right after the Declaration of Independence, that the statue was torn down and torn to pieces. You actually have a few of the original pieces of that statue. Talk about that. Why that was so significant?
We do, and we decided that we actually start the exhibits with that story, which is the middle of the story if you think about the history. But we wanted to start there because it is this incredibly exciting moment, and it's the ultimate act of rebellion: tear down the statue of the king, we sort of plunge you into the story, then we do step back and give you the background of how we got to that. And along the way, we really challenge you to become a rebel along with those who tore down the statue. But the statue was made of lead, and it was gilded, so it didn't look like lead.
It
looked like shiny gold. And when it was torn down, and they discovered that, they broke it up and they shipped it off where it was melted down into bullets to be used by the Continental Army.
Take that, King George.
And in fact, they referenced that. They called those bullets Melted Majesty, which they returned to the king's troops. Not every piece was melted down. Clearly, there were some in the crowd who grabbed a few fragments and saved them as souvenirs. Maybe they were the loyalists, we don't know. But a generation or two later, those fragments were donated to the New York Historical Society, which has very kindly loaned them to us, so that when you learn about the story, you can look at pieces of that statue that were such a central part of the revolution.
You have a lot of exhibits and artifacts that have been loaned, don't you?
Oh, we have some of them. I honestly think we have the richest, most important collection of artifacts that's been assembled probably since the Revolution itself. There are so many highlights. I can't begin to list them all, but Washington's war tent has to be one. We have original artwork from the period. We have weapons, canteens, and in some ways the most powerful elements, I think, are the ones that represent the simple pieces of equipment carried by the foot soldiers. You know, and a powder horn that's been decorated with a map of Valley Forge, or that bears the words liberty or death, and gives you an understanding that there's a reason these people were willing to risk their life and persevere through incredible hardship and setbacks for 8 years.
I mentioned earlier about, and you used the word loyalists, that not everyone was on board with this, were
no,
they?
Not at
they
all.
Were, again, considered themselves loyal British subjects, and there was a good percentage of people living in the colonies who didn't want to go against it. They thought things were good under Great Britain.
Well, Scott, at the outset, it was utterly illogical. I mean, as you learn in one of our exhibits, we have just beaten the French in the Seven Years' War. That means the North American continent is yours if you're a British colonist. You are now a citizen of the largest, most powerful empire since ancient Rome. What's wrong with that picture? How do you go from there to being in open rebellion over merely 15 years? And it wasn't, and even through those 15 years, not everyone was persuaded. They felt like the right thing to do was to stick with the king. You know, the leading political theory of the time is nations are defined around a king. With all their flaws, they are the anchor, the solid sense of tradition and authority, without which a nation just devolves into anarchy. Here we are rejecting a king. That by most political observers around the world, we're on the road to ruin.
As several of the exhibits show, that King George, after the French and Indian War ended, was beloved.
Very much so. Yeah.
I mean, it starts when you walk through the exhibits. It follows a chronological order from the end of the French and Indian War up through the Stamp Act, Boston Tea Party, you know, all the things that led to the first shots being fired at Lexington and Concord. Again, as a history nerd, one of the things that I really enjoyed was you actually have a piece of wood from the North Bridge at Concord.
Another one of our highlights. Absolutely, we do.
Now, that was found under the water, right?
It was preserved because it was underwater, which meant oxygen could not reach it. I mean, wood rots very quickly, but only if oxygen is present. And underwater, it was actually below the mud underneath the river. But it's one of the highlights.
Well, what's your favorite You have to have a favorite.
My favorite is Washington's war tent.
And we're going to talk about that in just a moment, okay. But go ahead.
But I will mention that because, as far as we can determine, it's the only tent to survive from the Revolution. But beyond that, and it just symbolizes so much about Washington, which you'll talk about in a few more minutes. But beyond that, what I really like are the personal items, the powder horn that's personalized with the rifleman's name, you know, the canteen. Because to me, that represents the real people who risk their lives day in, day out. And they're so moving to me, just so moving.
There are many artifacts there that, again, as a history nerd, I'm like, oh, that is really something that I've never seen before. And you mm-hmm. get the chills and the whole thing. But I guess it's General Benjamin Lincoln.
Yes.
A lot of people don't know this story that Cornwallis at Yorktown sent his second in command.
Yes, most historians think he feigned illness, that Cornwallis pretended to be ill so he could avoid the humiliation of surrendering.
Wow. Go to surrender your whole army and you don't show up because you're sick, huh?
So he sends Lincoln. So he sends his second in command out, who decides, well, it's British honor. I'm not surrendering to some lowly American provincial. He heads to Rochambeau. The French commander, the French general, Rochambeau refuses and points him to Washington. So, of course, the second in command heads over to Washington. Well, Washington looks at him, and he, too, refuses and points him to his second in command, General Lincoln. So it was very public, complete humiliation.
We're fortunate the war ended at that point.
Well, it didn't quite end.
No, that was the last
major battle.
Right.
But we didn't achieve the peace treaty for another 2 years.
And you had the French fleet right offshore at Yorktown. But
they're critical.
One of the key artifacts you have here is you have General Lincoln's sword.
We do have General Lincoln's sword, the general who, and he, ironically, he had been defeated by Cornwallis in his failed attempt to defend and hold the city of Charleston against British attack. So these wonderful ironies that play out in the field of Cornwallis. And of course, you know, the tradition is that the musical band played, the military band played the music from The World Turned Upside Down, which for the British, it really was.
It really did. Yeah. But just so many great stories inside these walls. It's a beautiful museum, and we're just so happy to be here and encourage everyone to come down. You know, we thought that as busy as the city is today, the traffic would be a nightmare. NFL draft this weekend, Penn mm-hmm. relays. Really didn't have a problem with traffic. And, you know, the museum itself is so big that you feel like you're never crowded.
Well, we're in the old city part. I mean, this museum is located 2 blocks from Independence
right.
Hall and about a block from
Third and Chestnut.
Third and Chestnut, about a block from where William Penn founded this city. And all those other things you mentioned, the NFL draft was way on the other side near the art museum. So no problem getting here. And you're right, we have built this museum to welcome and engage many, many people. There's lots of capacity. Tell your visitors to come. We're open every single day of the week. The ticket price is $19 for an adult. It's cheaper for children. But all of our tickets are a 2-day ticket, so you can come back the next day.
You know, as we were sitting here talking, and I was thinking about the highlights of the revolution that we do hear about, I wonder whether, now that this museum is here, now we know that it will be a stop for many people visiting Philadelphia, but I wonder whether there will be a renewed interest in the revolution.
Well, we hope so. That is our goal. Our mission is to inspire learning about the revolution and the core ideals that came out of the revolution of equality and freedom that make us a single people. So our intention is to spur interest. In fact, one of our goals in this museum is that when visitors have been here, they leave wanting to know more. And they're just starting their process, the adventure of learning and exploring the true meaning of the American founding.
Michael Quinn is the president and CEO of the Museum of the American Revolution. Mr. Quinn, thank you very much for being with us today.
Scott, it's a pleasure. And thank you for coming to the museum and bringing so many guests.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to this Smart Talk road trip from the Museum of the American Revolution in Philadelphia. The crown jewel of the exhibits at the new museum is the tent where General George Washington spent much of the Revolutionary War. Called the nation's first Oval Office by some, the tent is preserved here at the museum. I have not had the opportunity to see it yet, but I am looking forward to it. So many people have told me about this exhibit, and as you heard Mr. Quinn say, it is one of his favorite items here at the museum as well. Joining us to talk about the tent is Assistant Curator Matt Skick and Textile Conservator Virginia Whalen or Whelan?
Whalen.
Whalen. And I want to thank you very much, and I have to compliment you without even seeing the tent, because so many people who have seen it, well, first of all, they said, oh, you can't wait to see it. It is fabulous. It's emotional.
Yes.
I'm thinking, okay, it's a tent. But there's an 11-minute video that goes along with it. How is it emotional?
The tent itself is in a glass clay case dedicated just to the tent. We call it Washington's War Tent. It's part of this theatrical production in a 100-seat theater. And it's emotional because once you enter the theater, you don't see the tent at first, but you sit down for this presentation and beautifully illustrated and narrated. And then as the presentation goes on, the tent is dramatically revealed.
Don't tell everything. Let
me see. Well, yeah, we won't be surprised.
Yeah. So we'll leave it to...
They promised that I'm going to cry at this, so...
Yeah, so I'll leave it at that. It's dramatically revealed, and it's pretty emotional. It's some people have cried in the theater as a result of it.
What they've been able to do is connect an inanimate object with people, and you do feel a connection, and it's surprising. So I think that might be what's so moving.
And you mentioned that it is behind glass. Is it bulletproof glass?
It's some of the clearest glass you can get. It's very strong.
You didn't
glass.
Get that
it's,
at Windoworld.
Why would you suggest that? I don't know.
I saw something that said about it being, you know, that the glass is... It's
protective. UV filtered and it's very thick.
Okay. So, now I didn't picture people.
Yeah,
you know,
we don't want to suggest that.
British showing up and you know with muskets or anything.
Yeah. It did survive two wars.
That's right.
The
that's
Revolutionary
right.
War
that's
and
right.
the Civil
that's
War.
Right.
So.
All right. So the story itself of the tent. And by the way, I want to tell our listeners, and we have an audience here who will ask some questions in just a moment. We'll get to them in just a moment. The story of how the tent itself got here. Tell us about that. Because back in my original introduction, I talked about the story kind of starts at Valley Forge. We didn't really get into the museum itself, how it was supposed to be at Valley Forge, made its way here to Philadelphia, but the tent itself has quite a story.
It certainly does. And the tent's story begins during the Revolutionary War when it served as Washington's field headquarters tent. It was the tent we have here was his sleeping and office tent, so where he was writing letters. It was a command center for Washington when he was commander in chief. But the story doesn't end when the war ends. The tent survives, and it survives through the 19th century and 19th century conflicts in America, including the biggest conflict, the Civil War. The tent is almost nearly destroyed during the Civil War, but it's saved and preserved. Then it is sold to in 1909 to Reverend W. Herbert Burke, who was looking to found a museum at Valley Forge dedicated to the story of the American Revolution and George Washington's leadership. And Reverend Burke's collection that he began with the tent as the centerpiece is now forms the nucleus of the collection that we have here at the Museum of the American Revolution.
Now, Matt, you skipped over a part that I was hoping you would.
I skipped over a lot.
I know you did. Yeah, you went 20 years there. But Martha Washington's great-great-granddaughter was a Custis. She was married to Robert E. Lee.
Yes.
So the Lees had the tent at their Arlington mansion, and during the Civil War, that was one of the main targets for the Union Army. So the tent itself was captured, correct?
It was. So Arlington House, which is now on site at Arlington National Cemetery, was the Custis family home. And
Robert E. Lee married into money.
Yeah. And George Washington Park Custis, who is George Washington's step-grandson, built that home in order to house the Washington relics, so including the tent. And in addition, they had pieces of china. They had some of Washington's clothing. They had all of that there at Arlington House. And George Washington Park Custis's daughter is the woman who married Robert E. Lee. Mary Custis Lee married Robert E. Lee, and they lived at Arlington House. And at the beginning of the Civil War, a portion of the Union Army crossed the Potomac and captured Arlington House.
Right up there on the hill, and there was something symbolic about the cemetery.
Capturing the commander's the home, and there was an enslaved woman there named Selina Gray, who was actually given the keys to the Washington relics. She knew where they were hidden. And she spoke with one of the Union generals that was there, and was able to work out with him in order to get these relics into protective custody of the United States government.
That is really cool. Virginia, before we go to some of our audience questions, all right, textile conservator.
Correct.
I am really curious about what material, what that tent actually feels like.
The tent is made out of linen, regular linen. I mean, we have all seen it before, but it's hardy. And it's not that thin, but it's thinned over the years. So when they made a replica tent for our experiments before we set up this tent, and Williamsburg made it, so we called it our stunt double. So anytime we needed to test anything, we used the stunt double. And the weight of that tent, the brand new linen, was considerable compared to the weight of the Washington tent, which has thinned over the years, but is still pretty strong.
But it has to be preserved. And, you know, we had a description earlier about how it is behind glass, and it comes up out of the floor. There is a sign about no photography, not even non-flash photography. But how do you preserve a textile like that is that old?
We had a team. Scott Stevenson assembled an interdisciplinary team of conservator, curators, structural engineers, a tent maker, and journeyman tailors from Williamsburg. And we worked for 5 years to develop a system so that this tent could be supported and look at like it's accurately pitched in the field, like Washington would have been next to it, but had no stress at all. So Keyston Hood is the structural engineer group that created two umbrella-like structures that opened up to support a second tent, a pretend tent. We called it the sub-tent. And then the artifact goes on top of that so that the artifact does nothing except look good. It just rests on top of all this structure. But none of it can be seen. So when you go see it in the tent theater, you won't know what's going on behind it.
So are you like the rest of us that when you touch the tent, you said George Washington actually touched this?
Yes. Yes. And then you think, he was breathing around this tent, and who was talking to him, and did he spill his grog, or did the candle almost burn the tent up, and am I breathing his dust? I don't know. It gets exciting.
You didn't test for Washington dust?
It's been washed before, so I don't know how much is left.
I should mention to you that WITF Smart Talk road trips are supported by Roof Advisory Group, and we thank Roof Advisory Group. We enjoy going out on the road and talking to all the people that we visit in the different locations, but also talking to the audience as well. In fact, we have a couple members of our audience that we assume have questions or comments, one of the two. Go ahead, sir.
I have a question. I presume you had grand opening ceremonies. What did they involve?
We opened just over a week ago now. We opened on April 19th, the 242nd anniversary of the shot heard around the world, the battles of Lexington and Concord, 1775. We opened with great fanfare, but also we opened with a little bit of a commemoration and thinking back to the men and women who lost their lives in service of the fight for independence. So we started our celebration of the opening at the Tomb of the Unknown Revolutionary Soldier, which is at Washington Square Park, just a few blocks away from here. And we began with a religious service there, and song and the playing of taps. And then we led a procession of dignitaries and also representatives of the 13 original United States to Independence Hall. And we had a ceremony there with governors and lieutenant governors there. And then we continued the procession to the plaza at the front door of the museum. And we were honored to have Cokie Roberts, David McCullough, Vice President, former Vice President Joe Biden here to help us cut the ribbon and kick off our opening and welcome the members of the public into the museum. So it was quite a day, and I was happy to be a part of it. So,
sir,
this is a sort of a history question. Had King George III been involved in any major wars, say prior to the French and Indian War and the Revolution, to give the patriots an idea of what type of bloody battle they were in for in trying to take on the British government?
Well, there are plenty of veterans of the French and Indian War who fought in North America during the Revolutionary War on both sides of the conflict, in the British Army and the American Army. And then there were a number of the British generals had experience fighting in European wars, particularly the Seven Years' War, which the French Indian War was just a small part of. So yes, there was some experience on both sides of the conflict of warfare, and especially the experiences that were developed through those wars came into play during the Revolutionary War.
Even so, Washington, of course.
Washington he was a veteran of the French and Indian War, part of the Virginia Provincial Regiment.
In fact, there are some people who think that Washington started the war.
back in 1754, with a small raid on a French officer, yeah.
Yeah, and I think they kind of like threw something down and said, man, that American started the war. Sir.
Thank you. My wife and I are here as guests of Roof Advisory, and we're grateful for their generosity in allowing us to come to this impressive museum. I have two questions. Would the two of you tell us your professional backgrounds and also the background of your director? Are you Revolutionary War specialists, military historians, museum specialists, or what are your professional background?
I'm a textile conservator. I'm in private practice. I have a master's in art conservation from Winterthur University of Delaware. I've been practicing for 20 years. And so I was brought in as a consultant on this project and all the other textiles that you might see up in the gallery to conserve them and prepare them for exhibit.
And I'm assistant curator here at the museum, but I got my start. I have a BA in American history from American University down in Washington, D.C., but I have my master's degree from the Winterthur program in American material culture. So we have a conservation graduate from Winterthur and a material culture graduate. And I wrote my master's thesis on gunsmiths in Philadelphia and their role in the production of military arms in support of the American Army during the Revolutionary War. And some of the research that I did for that thesis is now part of the exhibits here. And so I was hired on to the project here at the Museum of the American Revolution back in June of 2016, right after I finished my master's degree.
And Matt just got published in Antiques and Fine Arts. He has an article on the Museum of the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. Just came out yesterday.
Just yesterday, yeah.
So. And the director's background, is he a Revolutionary War specialist?
Mike Quinn, our president and CEO, has experience of museum leadership at both Mount Vernon and also James Madison's home, Montpelier. So that's a part of his background.
And Mr. Quinn expressed the interest in sparking desire on the part of people who come here to know more about the Revolutionary War, and certainly your exhibits can contribute to that. Sometimes museums and learned institutions also have a public lecture series. Do you project having such a series here? And if so, with what frequency and who will be invited to speak?
We do plan to have that. We do plan to have a number of different types of education programs, including lecture series. We have an online email-based system called Read the Revolution right now. That is a every other week a new book or author is featured. And we plan to expand that into a lecture series now that we have a building. We have theater space here where we can host lectures. So, yes, we plan to do that.
Thank you very much for your question. Does anyone else have a question about the tent? Because we do have another historian who could probably answer your questions in the... No? Okay. All right. You know, I'm curious. Virginia, when you were talking about basically freelancing, are there other historic documents or materials that you have worked on?
Yes.
Shroud of Turin or anything?
No, but I have worked on Gandhi's shawl, or I've worked on the cloak that FDR wore at the Treaty of Yalta. I've worked on many Civil War flags, several Revolutionary War flags. So I've touched a lot of really important textiles, and the history behind them is what really makes them tantalizing. The people make them...
How do you handle them?
Carefully.
I thought that would be the answer, but...
You have to understand the context, the social, historical, and the context in which they were made, and understand how the materials that were used, and you have to understand them before you even begin to handle them.
You know, do you have any children?
I have three.
You ever tell them, out of the room?
No, actually, they are great. They've been trained at how to take coffee stains out of rugs and things like that.
That's good. Yeah. That's good.
How to pick up chairs properly, how to move things. So they're trained since birth.
Well, I was able to take a tour of the museum before we went on the air today, but I was not able to see the tent. So I'm looking forward to that as soon as the show ends, and I am really looking forward to it. I want to thank both of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Matt Skick
is
the assistant curator and textile conservator, Virginia Whelan. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Slavery is most often thought of in relationship to the Civil War. But slaves, blacks, and African Americans had roles in the Revolutionary War as well. In particular, slaves from Virginia that were caught between the two sides during the British invasions of 1781. There's an exhibit here at the Museum of the American Revolution that commemorates that history. It's called Finding Freedom. And joining us is one of the people instrumental in putting this exhibit together. Dr. Gregory J.W. Irwin is a military historian, author, and professor of history at Temple University here in Philadelphia. Dr. Irwin, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's great to be here.
As I just said, this was part of the revolution you don't hear a whole lot about. Slavery, most people think about the antebellum period and the time leading up to the Civil War itself. But let's talk about slavery in the United States, what wasn't the United States then, but the colonies, leading up to the war.
Well, it's history that hides in plain sight, because at the time of the Revolution, one out of every five Americans was black, and most of them were slaves. And slavery was not just consigned to the South. Most slaves lived down there because of the plantation system, but slavery existed throughout the 13 colonies. And you can see snippets. You can see black people in the background of paintings. You can see their artifacts. There are plenty of references to them in the documents. But a lot of historians, like other people, when they research something, they've already decided what they want to find. And they block out a lot of the things that are there that, well, shouldn't be blocked out.
Something that Dr. Irwin just said that I hope a lot of people noticed, slavery in the 13 colonies. At that time, it was not just in the South.
No, it was not just in the South. But most slaves were in the South, and when the British invaded the South, they were amazed by the large number of blacks who took advantage of their presence to make a bid for freedom.
What happened in 1781 in Virginia?
Well, in 1781, several British invasions occurred in the largest, richest, and most populous of the 13 states. The first was led by Benedict Arnold, the trader who'd become a British general.
He was a British general.
And he becomes the first Yankee. He's Connecticut-born to capture Richmond, Virginia on January 5th, 1781. But wherever his ships go, wherever his troops put ashore, slaves flock to the British. Exhibit here focuses on one of them. I came across the letters of a Quaker slave owner who wrote to Arnold asking him to return the slaves he had borrowed, including this likable 14-year-old boy named London. And he's such a great kid, and I'd really like to have him back. And he was probably misled by his uncle, so please return him. Subsequent research, though, in a document known as the Book of Negroes, which listed all the blacks that the British shipped out of New York after the war was over, likable London became a British soldier. He enlisted in Benedict Arnold's American Legion as a trumpeter and fought against the people who were enslaving him and his kin. And this is important because during the Revolution, Americans of all backgrounds are confronted with a variety of choices. They're in a variety of circumstances. And you don't have one revolution going on. You have a bunch of parallel revolutions. But they're all Americans trying to live their dream of freedom. And it's messy, and it's confusing. And it's like today, because we're all headed in different directions.
That's what I was thinking as you were mentioning it. One thing about the exhibit, and it is so noticeable because over the years in the textbooks, in the documentaries we've seen, the portrayal of the Revolution, you see all white faces in uniform. But in your Finding Freedom exhibit, is it London that is portrayed in
London?
The...
London is the fellow in the red coat and the life-sized exhibit, and there are five interactive exhibits, and you can follow the lives of five different slaves, including, four slaves and one free black, including London, and find out what happened to them and what choices they made at different parts of the war and how that worked out for them.
But it is very noticeable when you see that black face
in
a red coat in the British uniform.
But it wouldn't have been that unusual back in 1781 or 1776. Lots of black faces were part of the cast of characters in the Revolution, including a number who served on the side of the Patriots, too, just like the Indians. People were making the best bargains they could with the circumstances that confronted them.
All right, you mentioned the Indians. In the history of this museum, one of the entities that got involved from the very beginning was the Oneida Indian tribe. We didn't go through the history of the museum because it's quite a story itself, but the Oneida Indian tribe wanted to contribute $1 million toward this museum when it originally was going to be constructed in Valley Forge. There was some back and forth about where the museum could be built, how big it could be. National Park Service had some roles. Eventually it came to Philadelphia. There is an exhibit about the Oneida Indians. The Oneida Indians fought alongside the Continental Army, the Americans. Now, there were other tribes that were enemies, but I have to say that this probably, it's just a guess, is probably one of the only museums in America that portrays that and tells that story.
The Oneida themselves are very happy that story is being told. And it presents a council of tribal elders discussing what side should the Oneida back. There's at least one saying a pox on both their houses. We should just sit back and let them kill each other. And there are others talking about other options. One great thing about it is that it shows that in the governance of the Oneida, it wasn't just male voices that were heard, it was female voices. Abigail Adams asked John Adams to remember the ladies when the Continental Congress was putting together this new country called the United States. That didn't happen. It did happen among those Indian people.
We have a number of our listeners who are with us today who traveled from bus from the Public Media Center, WICS Public Media Center, and we have a microphone where they can ask some questions. Gentlemen, sir, you're on the air.
Thank you. I know you don't have the benefits of carbon dating, and we're only talking about an 8-year period, but I wonder, Have you been able to establish or even take a really good guess at what the oldest artifact that you have in the exhibit is?
Oh, gee, that would have to, that'd be a better question for someone from the museum staff. You know, I'm just a historian who consulted on certain aspects of it, but I can't begin to guess as to what would be the oldest, but everything is at least 240 years old.
I think when you go through the museum, there are dates attached to a number of the artifacts and the exhibits, so that might give you an idea because, you know, the very beginning of the museum, it goes chronologically, goes back to the French and Indian War, Seven Years' War, and the Stamp Act, the Boston Tea Party, and there's a replica of a Liberty Tree there. But again, I'm telling all these stories just from what I saw this morning. But apparently all 13 colonies had Liberty Trees where they would meet, share news. And this is a replica, but inside the Liberty Tree, there's a piece of wood from the last surviving Liberty Tree, which was in Annapolis, Maryland, that you can touch. It's another thing about the museum that's unusual. There are several items, several exhibits and artifacts that it says, please touch. You don't see that very often. So we keep the kids away from the swords and stuff like that, but you know, there are some things you can touch.
But you started around 1763.
Yeah.
So you know, some of the things commemorating and celebrating George III and the end of the Seven Years' War. Yeah. So I think that's a pretty good starting point there.
Ma'am?
I have a history question for you. I like the what-ifs of history. You know, what if this happened? What would have happened? And thinking as to how the war started, do you think it was more an inevitable thing that people that were in this new land would want to be ruled by themselves, or was it more in reaction to King George and his policies?
That's a wonderful question. I mean, when the British looked at this, they saw it as a civil war and something unnatural. They didn't see Americans as a separate people, but as part of the same stock. But, you know, there's certain people in the colonies who developed this sense of alienation early on. It had always been there to a certain extent. But the Puritans had left England because they thought it was hopelessly corrupt, and the only way to save Christianity was to create a new England over on this side of the Atlantic. So that kind of attitude persisted in New England. But New England was just part of the mix. Whether it was inevitable or not in 1763, whether the British could have made better choices, it reaches a certain point in you know, around 17. Well, when the British decide to crack down and close down the port of Boston to punish Boston for the Boston Tea Party and send troops in, impose martial law, that's when I think the real sense of inevitability kicks in.
Something you said a few minutes ago about the First Freedom exhibit, or Finding Freedom, I'm sorry, the Finding Freedom exhibit, you said a Quaker slave owner.
Yes.
Isn't that unusual?
Well, he was in Virginia, and if you wanted to make money, planting tobacco was the way to do it. But he's interesting because he wrote to another British general, still trying to get this same slave back, saying that my family were educating our slaves to free them when we think they're ready. But Virginia, at the same time, had passed laws making it impossible for masters, or very difficult, to manumit their slaves. And he and his friends are fighting to overturn those laws. But when a slave leaves him before he's ready to grant him his freedom, he wants him back.
Yeah, it's a different
story.
So
it's very contradictory.
And another artifact here, there's a book of poetry that was written by, was she an enslaved?
Phyllis Wheatley.
Yes.
I think she was free. Yeah, I believe she was free. Yes.
She wrote a book of poetry. The book is here. And she signed it. I looked at that and I thought, that signature, it looks like she signed it this morning. The material, I understand, is much different than what we have today. Mm-hmm. Paper made out of wood.
Yes.
Back in those days, there was cloth in the paper. But when you get a chance to see that book of poetry that she signed, that signature, first of all, the penmanship is incredible. But when you see how clear it is, it's just amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Sir, you have a question?
Yes, I'm not a history buff. My last American history course was probably over 60 years ago. And my question is this. are there things that I was taught 60 or more years ago that this museum that are wrong and that this museum is able to and has corrected?
You have waited a long time to ask that question, haven't you?
Well, the war ends the same way. American independence. What I think what it will do, instead of correct what you learned, I think it will expand on what you learned and add greater layers of richness. And you know, the nice thing about this museum, it takes the revolution off the pedestal where we've put it with our creation myth. It brings it down to our level. It lets us walk into it so we can experience it as our forebears did. And I think you will learn certain things, and you say, okay, that rings with what I learned in second grade. Boy, this is new. I never heard that before. So I think it will add to what most Americans know about the revolution.
Sir, I'm like you. I always want to know what we've heard the stories over the years. You know, we've heard about Betsy Ross sewing the first flag, and we don't know whether that actually happened or not. She may have sewed a flag, but you know. But anyway, stories like that. The British soldiers have always been portrayed as just ruthless, that they were savage. They would torture Americans. Was it that way? And what about American fighting people?
The British military has this tremendous sense of anger when the revolution breaks out, because they just can't understand why these people are rebelling. They're freer than anyone else in the world, and they're, for the most part, even more affluent than people back in England. Even people who have been sympathetic to their stand in taxes just don't understand why they want to make this break. So the British could be pretty rough at the beginning of the war, and there's also an awful lot of looting, rape, some murder that helps to bring New Jersey up in revolt to set the stage for Washington's crossing of the Delaware. The British, though, at the same time are saying, we're trying to win hearts and minds. We can't do this. We've got to get the troops under control. So they're going to fight a constant battle during the war to discipline the men and try to protect the loyalists and try to bring fence sitters and wavering patriots over to their side. Sometimes they're better at it than others. But, you know, that ambiguity, I think, gets communicated here. And as for the American fighting man, he's not shown as a Superman. Mm. He's shown as somebody who can have a rough day, can feel fear. He ultimately prevails. But the outcome of the war, when you're walking through here, doesn't feel preordained.
You could have been describing Iraq.
Yes.
When you're talking about a guerrilla war, winning the hearts and minds. Mm-hmm. Sir, you have a question?
Yes, tongue twister question for me. Every time I've gone by the White House, I'm drawn to the statuary in the Park Cross, and the name is quite long on it, and it's taken me several trips by.
You're going to say?
And I cannot pronounce it, so therefore it's tough asking, but I believe it's Polish-Lithuanian. General,
and it would be,
yeah, how right. Do you pronounce that again, the full name, if you could? I only know him as Andrew Thaddeus.
The way I pronounce it is Kosciuszko, but if there's anyone out there of Polish ancestry, they might be grinding their teeth right now.
Kosciuszko?
Yes.
And could you give me a thumbnail on what he did in the revolution?
Well, he was a Polish patriot. You know, Poland was not an independent country back then. It was divided between Russia, the Austro-Hungarian Empire, I believe Prussia had a chunk of it. The Poles periodically rebelled. He was involved in those efforts, but when you lose a rebellion, you gotta leave the country. So he came here with a number of foreign officers who were attracted by the American Revolution and its stand against monarchy, and offered his services to Washington. Some of these guys turned out to be duds, but Kosciuszko was a skilled engineer, and he played an important role in preparing American fortifications around little-known places like West Point, things like that.
And, of course, the person who came to the United States from Europe that was hailed as a hero was Lafayette.
Marquis de Lafayette, 19 years old.
19 years old.
But he says, here I am, make me a general. But the Congress realized this guy's an aristocrat, he's got connections, if we want France to support us, we'll make him a general. And eventually proved himself.
Dr. Gregory J.W. Irwin, who is a military historian, author, and 8 books?
9 now.
9 yeah, books? Yeah, yeah. You're writing all the time, aren't you?
Well, they pay us to do research.
And he is a professor of history at Temple University. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Just a fantastic time here today, and I'm glad that you tuned in, and hopefully these stories were fascinating to you as they have been to our audience here at the Museum of the American Revolution. Encourage you to visit 3rd and Chestnut Street in Old City, Philadelphia, just 2 blocks from Independence Hall, the Liberty Bell. It's all here within like a 4-block area, so you could spend a day. I was talking to a lady earlier today, said this is her second day here at the museum because there is so much to see. This Smart Talk road trip is supported by Roof Advisory Group, and we want to thank Roof Advisory Group for being a supporter of Smart Talk road trips. Our next road trip will be May 23rd when we will be at Willow Valley Retirement Community, and just so happens we're talking about another war. Ken Burns has a documentary that will air on WITF-TV and PBS this fall on the Vietnam War. And we're going to focus on Vietnam at the next Smart Talk road trip on May 23rd. So we invite you to come out to the theater. I understand they have a theater at the Willow Valley, and there will be a lot to talk about at that time as well. So, again, I want to thank all our guests for being with us today. And, again, come out for our Smart Talk road trips. We'll enjoy having you. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.